From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tragic failure. That's what former New York Times columnist Tom Wicker calls racial integration in America. He says one solution is a new political party.
The interests, particularly the economic interests of minority groups and of the poor and exploited, are not really being attended to by either major party. And it's my judgment that if those groups form their own party and begin to express their own interests, one or the other of the two major parties, probably the Democrats, would fall all over themselves trying to win those votes back.
And Derek Bell has a new book out called Gospel Choirs, Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home. We'll talk about the permanence of racism.
Whiteness in this society is a kind of property. And this is a nation that is really built and based on property. Many people don't have that much property. But what they do have is the sense of being white and identifying with people across this huge economic divide based on whiteness. It serves as the glue that keeps a society together that otherwise one would think would be having major class wars.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, public broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. A G7 counter-summit today attacked the world's seven leading industrial countries for putting the fight against terrorism at the top of their summit agenda at the expense of poverty and nuclear hazards. The leaders of the United States, Germany, Britain, France, Japan, Italy, and Canada, which make up the official group of seven, have made terrorism a central issue of their summit following Tuesday's bomb attack in Saudi Arabia that killed 19 U.S. soldiers. But environmentalists said unsafe nuclear reactors in Eastern Europe were a much bigger security threat than terrorists. Hoping to make the tobacco issue go away, Bob Dole told one of his sharpest critics that he's no medical expert when he declares that smoking is not necessarily addictive. But Dole still insists that from his personal observations, tobacco may or may not be addictive. That's what got Dole in trouble with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who served as Surgeon General under President Reagan. Koop said Dole's remarks either exposed his abysmal lack of knowledge of nicotine addiction or his blind support of the tobacco industry. And members of Congress would no longer be able to raise money at Capitol Hill fundraisers under a new proposal from three House lawmakers who've pushed campaign finance reform this year. As hope for passing a broader bipartisan reform bill dims, Congress members Martin Meehan, a Democrat of Massachusetts, Christopher Shays, a Republican of Connecticut, and Linda Smith, a Republican of Washington, proposed bans in two areas yesterday: congressional fundraisers within 50 miles of the Capitol and unlimited donations to political parties. And the White House is expected to release today the results of a 15-month investigation into charges that Washington knew more than it admitted about Americans tortured or killed in Guatemala. This, according to human rights groups. Officials of these groups say President Clinton's Intelligence Oversight Board will release a summary of the report this afternoon after briefing several people, including Sister Deanna Ortiz, a U.S. nun who says an American was present when she was raped and tortured by Guatemalan military in 1989. And Labor Secretary Robert Reich is taking part in two events aimed at eliminating the exploitation of children in the garment and soccer ball industries. This morning, he will participate in kickoff ceremonies for Foul Ball, an organization formed to keep Pakistani children from stitching soccer balls for companies like Nike. The secretary is also holding open hearings on international child labor. And finally, we got this note from the Washington Feminist FactsNet. They are giving the SICK Award, that's the Sexism in Congress Award, to Joe Barton, a Republican congressmember from Texas, for his reply to Secretary of Energy Hazel O'Leary's statement during a congressional hearing that members of Congress wanted her ousted. When O'Leary said, "Some in Congress wanted to take me out by Christmas," Barton replied, "There are numerous male members that are unmarried that would be delighted to take you out before Christmas." The Feminist FactsNet says if you're a female voter who'd like to take Barton out on November 5th, you can tell him so by calling him at 202-225-2002. That's 202-225-2002. You're listening to Democracy Now! Joining me is my co-host from Chicago, Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And we're joined in the Washington studio by Tom Wicker, a former New York Times columnist and now the author of a new book causing quite a stir. It's called tragic failure, racial integration in America. We're talking at a time when churches are being burned down across the South, when the Supreme Court has just handed down a decision invalidating predominantly African-American districts, when the New York Times has just come out with a report showing that the income gap is wider than it's been since World War II. Tom Wicker, what do you propose?
I think the Supreme Court decision in the congressional district cases and the Times report on income diversity is very relevant to my book. I'm proposing in the book that blacks should separate themselves from the Democratic Party, and not just blacks, the poor and the affluent generally. And this is could conceivably be quite a political base, because Census Bureau tells us that by the middle of the next century, what we now call minority groups will be about nearly 50% of the total population. We know also that about half of our population just doesn't vote at all. They've apparently feel that, or many of them feel that, they have no stake in politics. So if you could combine all those people, you would have a pretty considerable political base, and that would include, of course, the white people who are poor and exploited today, and there are a lot more of them than there are blacks. Now, I don't for one moment suggest it would be easy to pull all those groups together, but they do have at root a lot of common interests, and I do think that over the next half century or quarter of a century even, they will become even more exploited and even less a part of the general prosperity of the country, and therefore I think the impetus for them to strike out on their own politically will be increased. And the reason I think they should do that is because I think that both of the major parties, Democrats and Republicans, basically want to win and are trying to win and aim at winning the votes of the white middle class. That's understandable because there are more of them, of course. But at the same time, it means that the interests, particularly the economic interests of minority groups and of the poor and exploited, are not really being attended to by either major party. And it's my judgment that if those groups form their own party and began to express their own interests, one or the other of the two major parties, probably the Democrats, would fall all over themselves trying to win those votes back. That's the historical function of third parties in America, to attract the interest of one of the major parties, which then will try to express enough of that third party's ambitions and goals so that they will come back to the major party. And I believe that would happen here, and I think it should happen.
Well, Mr. Wicker, the subtitle of your book is Tragic Failure, Racial Integration in America.
Yes.
That the attempt at racial integration has failed or has been half-heartedly attempted. But the point that you make is that it seems to be unlikely that whites will willingly integrate with African Americans. Why do you think poor whites, who have been notoriously averse to the notion of integration, would be more disposed to coalesce with blacks, with African Americans in an independent political formation?
Well, I think for two reasons, first of which I've already stated, and that is that as the years go along, I think the commonality of interests between poor blacks and poor whites is going to become more and more compelling. I mean, the lack of decent housing, for example, the lack of good police protection, poor nutrition, the fact that the criminal justice system, I think, is biased, and so I think all of those things are going to drive people more and more together. I don't suggest that's going to happen this year or even by the year 2000, but I think it's going to happen as time goes along. And the second reason that I suggest that is because if you look back at 1988, Jesse Jackson won a number of state primaries that he could not have won with black votes alone, which means that if there's good leadership and if the case is well stated, as I think it was then, why, you can put together a coalition of blacks and whites. That wasn't a winning coalition in terms of his winning the presidency, but it certainly was a winning coalition in terms of expressing the fact that there are a lot of people out there who agreed with that kind of political approach. And I think, in retrospect, that Jesse Jackson should have had more recognition from the Democratic Party in 1988 than he did. Now, I hasten to add, because I like Jesse Jackson, but at the same time I'm not blind to the situation, I don't think he's the proper leader for the party that I'm suggesting, because unfortunately he carries too much baggage. There are too many white people who really resent Jesse Jackson. He is, I think, going to be recognized as a pioneer in black politics, but pioneers often are not the people who reap the reward.
In 1988, do you think he should have left the Democratic Party?
Well, I won't say that. That's every man's judgment to make and every person's judgment to make. And he did well enough in 1988 that I'm sure he thought there was more to be gained by building on that within the Democratic Party. And that's one reason why I would suppose that most black political leaders today, particularly in the cities, are not going to welcome or at least not follow up on my suggestion here, because they have a vested interest in the Democratic Party. They've achieved status, and they've achieved a certain seniority. They have committed posts in Congress and so forth, and they're not likely going to give that up, and I wouldn't blame them.
But there is a great deal of activity out there that is seemingly coalescing around your idea. In fact, one of the notions that came up during the Million Man March was almost exactly what you're prescribing.
Well, I think that's right, and I think there is a lot of activity and interest in this, and I expect the leadership, and the leadership is very important in American politics. So much depends upon personality. The leadership is very important, but I expect the leadership to grow up outside, if it does, if it grows up at all, I expect it to grow up outside of the presently recognized black leadership, all of which, to use the phrase I used before, I think carries a little too much baggage.
We're talking to Tom Wicker. He is author of Tragic Failure, Racial Integration in America. He's also written a number of other books, including a book about Richard Nixon.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask you about the social policies of Richard Nixon versus Bill Clinton. In fact, didn't affirmative action get passed under President Nixon?
Well, it didn't get passed in that sense. That suggests a law. I think it was more of an executive action, but it became formalized. Actually, the first affirmative action programs, I think, began the Johnson administration. But the Philadelphia plan, formalized in the Nixon administration, which had to do with integrating what were then lily-white construction unions in the city of Philadelphia, that was indeed the first formal affirmative action program.
Would you say that President Nixon was more liberal domestically than actually President Clinton is?
Well, comparative judgments like that are difficult to make. I think, however, I could make a very strong case, and I did when I was wrote that book, that President Nixon was fundamentally a progressive president on domestic affairs. And I think I could make a pretty strong case, and I try to do it in this book, that President Clinton is not. Now, exactly whether you'd say one is better than the other, I'd leave that to the judgment. But I think President Clinton is showing in his current manifestation, running for re-election, he is, in fact, co-opting a Republican program. That may be very good politics in terms of his re-election. I'm not suggesting it's not. But I don't think he's really addressing the fundamental problems of the country.
Mr. Wicker, you know, some of your arguments resemble those of Louis Farrakhan. The no hope among the two political parties, that blacks will become increasingly redundant economically. How do you rate black nationalism? What role do you think black nationalism will play in the coming years? Because black Americans seem to be orbiting around those ideas much more than they did in the past.
Yeah, well, black nationalism as such, as expressed in the organization led by Louis Farrakhan, I think he's got an element of hatred in it that I am sorry to be linked to. I don't much admire Louis Farrakhan and many of his ideas. I don't. However, having said that, and looking back to the Million Man March and so forth, I do think that there must be a considerable appeal to what Farrakhan is preaching, aside from the anti-Semitism and so forth, because if I understand it, black nationalism is a very powerful force within the black community in terms of membership and so forth. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that he is preaching or advocating black self-reliance, political self-reliance, then I approve of that. And I think that is going to be a major factor in the future. And once again, I say that, as I said earlier on this program, that I think black leadership today, which certainly would include Louis Farrakhan, I do not believe is the leadership that's going to bring about the kind of thing I'm suggesting, because I think Farrakhan is a very good example, and for very different reasons, Jesse Jackson is another, there's too much white animosity towards those people. Whether that's deserved or not is another question, but I think it's there, and it doesn't do any good to suggest it is not.
Considering the racist climate in this country, don't you think that is inevitable for any African-American leader?
Well, no, not necessarily, because what I'm suggesting and what I think is the right way to go, I'm not suggesting, as I've been accused of, redistribution of wealth or anything like that. I'm suggesting an enlargement of the economic pie so that everybody could have a larger share of it. And that would include a lot of white people. It would include poor white people. And so I think someone who's leading in that direction is not necessarily going to become an unpopular figure among whites. And I feel that that's one of the main indictments I would make of the current administration. I think the Clinton administration and the Federal Reserve Board are governing, or at least their economic policies are designed primarily to avoid inflation. And I think the threat of inflation is fairly remote. But if you're governing in order to avoid inflation, what that means is that you are not governing to achieve economic growth. And I think what we need in this country is economic growth, the expansion of the economic pie, so that everyone can have a larger share without anyone being deprived of their current share.
Well, you're suggesting a full employment program?
I certainly am. Full employment is a phrase that not too many years ago, a quarter of a century ago, was very very current in politics. You don't hear that anymore. Who advocates full employment today? And in fact, the Federal Reserve Board and other economists now will tell you that if you can get down to 6% unemployment, that is 6% of our workforce unemployed, and that's millions of people, if you can get down to that, that is the equivalent of full employment. If you get down lower than that, you're going to cause a wage push inflation. And that's why I say they're running to cause to avoid inflation rather than to cause economic growth. Now, the interesting and tragic thing is that during the Kennedy administration, and I'm not touting that administration, I'm just using that as a benchmark in time, a calendar benchmark, 30-odd years ago, 3% unemployment. 3% unemployment was considered full employment. If you drop below that, you'd cause a wage push inflation. In 30 years, that figure has doubled. It's doubled to 6%. Right. And I think that's a tragic example of what's happened in that period of time.
You make a strong case in your book, Tragic Failure, that President Clinton clearly does not represent African Americans. What are the positions that he's adopted? What are the policies he's instituted that have hurt blacks in this country?
Well, I won't say hurt so much as I think have just simply not helped. And clearly, I think that the underclass, so-called, the black ghetto in our cities, is the number one problem in America. I think that's a cancer eating at our vitals. And President Clinton addressed himself to that problem out in his speech in Memphis about 2 years ago. And he recognized clearly what the problem was. He said three times in that speech, and I quoted in my book, three times that the problem is the lack of jobs in the inner city, the lack of the discipline that work brings. And he recognized the problem. And yet in that whole speech, he did not make one single recommendation as to what to do about it. Now, I try to be fair-minded about this, and I know that bringing economic betterment to the inner city is not easy. It's not easy, and therefore you can't make a glib proposal to get it done. We've had too much of that, and it's a very difficult proposition, and it's going to take some long-term policy, and it's going to take some enlightened and eloquent political leadership, which I don't think Clinton has provided. To get specific on things, he sponsored and worked hard for and boasts about a crime bill that will produce more prisons, more policemen, more death penalties, but won't do very much about the prevention of crime in the beginning. I don't see the point myself of punishing crime after the fact. It seems to me to make a lot more sense to try to prevent crime before the fact. He's not doing that. Just recently, to bring it up to date, he proposed a college tuition tax credit. Who can be against that? Not I. Not anyone who is who's ever paid college tuition. But the fact of the matter is, that's an appeal to the white middle class, because it's white middle class kids that go to college and need the tuition tax credit. In fact, there are more black males in prison today than there are in higher education. Plus, that is a proposition that would lower federal revenues that might be used in some way for the kind of economic expansion that I think we need above all else.
Tom Wicker, we have to break. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil. Tom Wicker, presidential candidates have often campaigned against African Americans to get votes. I mean, you had a candidate, Clinton, Governor Clinton, posing in a photo opportunity with Sam Nunn, the senator from Georgia, before a prison chain gang with all black men in the background. You had him golfing at a segregated golf club in Little Rock, Arkansas. He certainly knew that it was an all-white golf club.
And going back to Arkansas to make sure a death penalty got carried out.
That's right, right when he was campaigning to cover up for the Jennifer Flower scandal at the time. It was happening right about that time. Now, let's go back in time to President Reagan, who did a similar thing that you write about. And interestingly, you bring in Trent Lott, who is the new Senate Majority Leader.
Well, I brought him in at that point in my book only because President Reagan opened his campaign in 1980, made his first campaign appearance in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is an unheard-of campaign stop. Not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, Mississippi. That is where the three civil rights workers had been murdered and buried in an earthen dam there. Reagan deliberately chose that spot to open his campaign, and I think it was powerfully symbolic, and it did send a message to the country. And he appeared in Mississippi to open his campaign, which not many, either Democratic or Republican candidates, would do ordinarily. He appeared at the invitation of Trent Lott, who told him that if he came to Mississippi, he could carry the state. And as I recall, he did. But I want to hasten to add, Trent Lott has been elected to replace Bob Dole, and I'm not necessarily characterizing him, I hardly know him, other than as a senator from Mississippi, and therefore and as a Republican conservative, both of which he is publicly. I don't know that he is in any way any more racist or at all racist than some other Senate leader might be.
Oh, okay. You're saying that that the leadership that you anticipate that will provoke these changes, or at least to gather together these discontented elements of the Democratic Party,
yes,
will have to be someone who's kind of a post-race candidate, someone who promotes race-neutral kinds of programs?
I think so. I think this has to be race-neutral. I believe we have seen enough to know in the past 30 years that programs that can be interpreted as being pro-black, whether in fact they are or not, for example, affirmative action, if they can be interpreted that way, if white people are going to fear that their programs to advance blacks at the expense of whites, they're not going to support them. And therefore, I think that we're going to have more nearly race-neutral policies, even though those policies might be devoted, and I trust they would be, to the economic advancement of poor people. Poor people, if you say that collectively, and that's what I'm advocating here, there are a lot more of them are white than black.
Do you think issues of cultural issues that many Afrocentrists talk about, like white supremacy, historical deprivation of blacks, and also the exclusion of black participation in the March of Civilization and all of that, do you think that has any importance in this debate?
Well, I think it does, because I think that all too many whites don't realize that. For example, I often hear, and people ask me, usually in a hostile fashion, why black Americans can't do as well economically as many immigrant groups. And I try to explain that, you know, blacks are not immigrants. American blacks are not immigrants. They've been here since the 16th century. They were imported in Jamestown. I try to point out that blacks are Americans like all the rest of us. Blacks fought in the Indian Wars. They've supported the Christian faith, as I say. And I think it's arguable that black music is the number one export of American culture to the rest of the world. You might dispute that, but I certainly think it is a major export, if not the number one export.
So, I agree with you on that one.
So blacks are fully Americans and should be regarded as such. Now, people who come here as immigrants from Asia or Europe often are well-educated to begin with. They are well-motivated in the fact that they come here. They're trying to get ahead and so forth. They have had an entirely different experience from the oppression and second-class citizenship that blacks have suffered in this country. And often they're more willing to take a bottom-scale job than blacks because they're not Americans. The immigrants are coming here. They're trying to get ahead. They'll do almost anything. That's to their credit. I'm all for that. But to compare them, to compare American blacks to well-educated, highly motivated Asians who come here and work hard is to compare apples and oranges, in my judgment.
Would you say it's inaccurate to characterize your book, which many people are saying, is that Tom Wicker is calling for a black political party and saying that African Americans should leave the Democratic Party and go to a party that actually represents some kind of hope for change for them in America?
It would be accurate to say that I do advocate that blacks should leave the Democratic Party. It would not be accurate to say that I advocate a black political party. I think black abandonment, to use the proper word, of the Democratic Party would be a signal bell. It would be a good beginning. It would be a dramatic beginning of a party of the poor and disadvantaged, a radical economic party that would advance. We talked earlier about full employment, that would advance economic growth, that would advance the idea of a larger economic pie with a bigger share for everyone. I don't think that merely a black political party would be effective. I think that's a loser almost in the face of it. At the moment, my last check, blacks are only about 12% of the population. But they're going to be more. Minority groups in general, by about the year 2050, are going to be about 50% of the population. Plus, there are a lot of white people, as I pointed out, who would join in such a thing, I think would join in such a thing, if properly led. So it's not a black political party, but it is black abandonment of the Democratic Party. After all, the blacks left the Republican Party, as I understand it historically, about in the 1930s, because of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, and not least because of Eleanor Roosevelt. And they remained in the Democratic Party, except for flirtation with Republicans during the Eisenhower years, because under the Truman and Johnson and Kennedy administration, great civil rights advances were made. And all that is, that's fair enough. But the elimination of legal segregation in the South was a visible, reachable target in the 1960s, and blacks and whites combined to reach that target, to reach that goal, a good thing. There is no such goal now. There's nothing like this. There's very little that can be done by passage of a law, so that I think it's a very different situation now, and I think it has to be achieved politically, and blacks have got to take the lead, which I think they should and can do, but I am not advocating a party limited to blacks. I think that would be a loser.
In fact, you promote the idea of integration, and from your defined in your terms, because
yes.
Integration in the way it was defined publicly is really an idea, really whose time has passed. I think neither African Americans nor whites never really accepted it because it connoted federal encroachment on their privileges, but now many African Americans are also rejecting the term integration. But you don't mean the conventional wisdom notion of integration. What exactly do you mean by the idea?
Well, I define it in my book. I do not mean, you're quite right, there's sort of an amalgamation, a melting pot of thesis here. I define integration, at least in my views, as being separate groups who live together in amity and who have equal rights and equally observed rights and do not either threaten or exploit the other. And I think that's entirely possible. I think we can do that in this country. We have religious denominations that live together that way. We have men and women live together that way. You don't have to melt everybody into one big pot. And I don't think we can do that. And I think the kind of integration that I've just described is much more attainable and reachable than the so-called colorblind society. And when I read Supreme Court decisions, the most recent one I think by Mrs. O'Connor, in which she says we now have a colorblind society, I think that is totally wrong. You only have to walk down a street in any major city in this country and see that we do not have a colorblind society. We never have had. We've had a very color-conscious society for hundreds of years, and we still do. And I don't think we're going to get to the point in this country or any other, I don't think we're going to get to the point where people don't recognize color, don't think anything about color, have no regard for color. I don't think we're going to get to that. I think this where we can get and where we should try to get is where people respect the other person regardless of their color.
Tom Wicker, thanks for joining us. Tom Wicker is author of Tragic Failure, Racial Integration in America. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, Derek Bell, author of Gospel Choirs.
Hit 'em a little, hit 'em, hit 'em, hit 'em.
This is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington, joined by my co-host in Chicago, Salim Wakil, who is a senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And we're joined in our Washington studio by Derek Bell, a visiting professor at New York University Law School, dismissed by Harvard University Law School from his position there for refusing to end his two-year leave, through which he protested the absence of minority women on the law faculty. We're going to talk about that in a little while. But right now, his latest book is Gospel Choirs, Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home. Salim.
Yes, Mr. Bell, I was struck by your latest offering, as I was struck by the other ones then, in which you seem to use parables and stories to deal with issues that others seek to confront, kind of, with no nonsense in essay form and what. Why have you chosen to kind of elliptically approach these very, very crucial issues?
Well, I have a good model in Jesus who used the parables to make points that folk probably knew but were reluctant to acknowledge. And I find, with my students, and I've wrote a lot of the stories initially for students, that they have rather set views, even the liberals who tend to enroll in my courses. And through the use of story, I can have them compare their long-held views with those that are expressed in the story. And it's a less personal kind of evaluation that they're able to make. And I think that they're able to compare them. The Space Traders, which is in my previous book, was written initially in order to make the point that the kind of sacrifices that blacks involuntarily make so as to promote white interests didn't stop when the Constitution was written, didn't stop during a number of the eras in history at the end of the Reconstruction period and what have you, but that they could happen today. And having a story in which people come from outer space and offer America all kinds of goodies that would guarantee prosperity for 100 years and ask in return only that they be able to take away all black Americans. And having a referendum on that issue with the country voting overwhelmingly to accept the aliens' trade offer. I would ask audiences, how could that happen? How would we really vote? And almost every black responds, of course, America would accept a trade. And whites are more reluctant. But when I say, I don't want to know how you vote, but just tell me about how the whites you know in your community, if they could go into the privacy of their voting booth, would a majority of them vote for the trade? Let me see your hands. And you'd see the hands reluctantly go up. You got through that story, Salim, a kind of acknowledgement of what you already knew but were reluctant to kind of put out there. And the story enables you, it seems to me, to do that.
And what do you think that says about our society, the fact that once you got most whites to be honest, they would admit that they think people would accept a trade? What does that say about this culture that we're in at this point?
I think it helps explain what we generally refer to as the melting pot. That is, in this country, from the very beginning, and including right now, people who are as disparately set in terms of their economics, in terms of their opportunities, in terms of a whole wide range of things, are nevertheless able to identify on the basis of whiteness. That whiteness in this society is a kind of property. And this is a nation that is really built and based on property. And many people don't have that much property. But what they do have is the sense of being white and identifying with people across this huge economic divide based on whiteness. It serves as the glue that keeps a society together that otherwise one would think would be having major class wars.
Dr. Bell, we just heard from Tom Wicker, who's written a new book called Tragic Failure. He quotes you at the beginning of his book. He quotes from your book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, The Permanence of Racism, the book you wrote before Gospel Choirs. What about the permanence of racism? Do you see an end to this hostility against African Americans anytime soon?
Not as long as our country is structured as it is. That is, with tremendous disparities in which race or racism serves to bridge this gap in part. There are other things that bridge it as well, but race is a major thing. It's why, Amy, there is such rabid opposition to affirmative action, and yet, on the other hand, very little upset when the statistics come out, as they do almost monthly. Nobody's keeping them hidden, about the growing disparity between the rich and the poor. The top 1% now holding 40% of the wealth. That's almost unprecedented, even in a history where through the 19th century there were these tremendous disparities. And much of that has come in the last 20, 30 years.
In fact, the New York Times just reported that under Clinton, that gap has increased much more so than under Reagan.
That's amazing. That's in the story just a few days ago. That's right. And yet there's not a political fallout. Salim, am I wrong on this?
It seems to me that
explains a part of why racism is not all hate. It's a sense of entitlement, you see, a sense of entitlement that makes you impervious to some of the real inequalities that you are suffering based on class and status.
What do you think would be the best way to make the case for affirmative action today when you've got the Democrats and the Republicans going after it?
That's very tough, Amy. I think that if it's called affirmative action, if it's called preferential hiring, if it's called safe black districts, it's going to lose, not only in the courts, not only in the Congress, but in the society. It's crazy. Whites need affirmative action based on class at least as much as blacks need it on the basis of race. And yet, for example, the studies show that legacy admits, most of whom are whites, that is, kids whose parents are alumni of a particular school, generally present credentials about the same as minority admits. There's no opposition to legacy admits. There's tremendous opposition in the courts and in the country to affirmative action. Go figure. Dr. Bell,
Tom Wicker suggested that perhaps we should adopt more race-neutral programs that attack issues on that class from that class perspective, and that would lessen some of the racial antagonisms that often emerge when we discuss these issues. How do you regard that?
If it would work, it would be fine. The problem is there is such a fixation on keeping blacks down. My face is at the bottom of the well analogy again. Is that it's very difficult to generate the kind of political support for race-neutral reforms. Look what happened to health care, you see. Some major entities through the media and what have you were able to pretty much shut down a program, not the best program, but at least a better program than we now have. And a part of that, not a major part, but a part of that was that, damn, I don't want to be paying for them babies that them black mm-hmm. women are having. I don't want to pay for the health care for those folk up there on the, laying out on the avenue. That was a part of this thing, you see. Mm-hmm. And the and I think other reforms. Hilbrunner, the economist, said years ago that the reason this country is so far behind in social reforms than Western European countries, they don't have anything like our wealth in health care, in prison reform, in housing, in protection for the elderly, is because those are, he suggested, homogeneous societies. And it's easy to make the argument, there but for the grace of God go I. In this country, where it's so heterogeneous, there are a lot of advantages of that. But one of the disadvantages is that opponents to those programs are always able to twist reform efforts into, well, prison reform is coddling black criminals. Welfare reform is aiding, abetting these women having babies and stuff like that. When you tell them there are a hell of a lot more white teenage pregnancies than there are black, you must be lying, you see.
Right. Yes.
Dr. Bell, we're going to have to break for a minute. Derek Bell is author of a number of books. His latest, Gospel Choirs, Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil in Chicago. We'll be back in just a minute. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington. Our guest in the studio here is Dr. Derek Bell, author of Gospel Choir, Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home. Salim Wakil joins us from Chicago. I wanted to stop for a second and ask you about your own story. You're currently a professor at New York University Law School. You were a professor at Harvard University Law School. And for this, you have my undying admiration for what you did at Harvard. Explain why you left or why you were forced out.
Amy, you know, I was the first black, or Salim, the first one who acknowledged it on that faculty, the faculty that had gone on for well over a century. Now, for me to figure that, oh, they finally found some black person that's qualified would have been crazy, because Bill Hastie, the first black federal judge, was a Harvard grad, law review member. Charles Houston, the father of the civil rights movement of the 40s and 50s, was on a law review graduate. Others, you see, they didn't come along at the right time. I came along after Martin Luther King was killed, after the riots, and when many of the institutions across this country said, uh-oh, we better do something on a token basis. Plus, the black students were really pressuring for this, and I was the beneficiary. It seemed to me that I always had an obligation to try to do for others what those students had done for me. And the effort to get more minority faculty was an ongoing struggle. And finally, we had a relatively good composition of black males, but most of our minority students are female. And there were none, and we finally had a visitor, a woman who did everything we had hoped a woman would do. And the faculty said, no, well, she's not good enough. I mean, she was fabulous.
Who was she?
This is Regina Austin at the University of Pennsylvania. And the next year, they had Anita Allen. Also wonderful, less radical than Regina. I thought, oh, she'll be more acceptable. No. They didn't want her either. Well, I just decided that after the Regina turned down that I had to do something on my own, and I just suggested, well, I can't convince you that I can't serve the needs of all of the students in a way that a woman of color could, and so I'm taking leave without pay until you get it together. And I took 1 year, and I stayed on campus, taught a course for free for students who would take it without credit, a marvelous experience. And then the next year I went down to NYU, and I asked for a third year, and they said, no, we have a rule that you can only take 2 years. And I said, that's a good rule. People shouldn't be able to go off and, you know, work in government or take other prestigious positions and hold open their position. But mine is a basis of conscience, et cetera, et cetera. No, 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 you got to come back. And I really think that they felt they would never give up their positions. So this black guy certainly is not going to give up his. And I didn't feel I had any alternative but to hold to what I thought was right. The message, of course, is that they still haven't hired anybody. You see, I think there's some sort of offer out to Lonnie Guinier, who is better known than almost everybody on the faculty. And even that is not as fulsome as it might be. But the message is that worthwhile things happen when you do what you think is right. A whole army of students that I've never taught know what I did. It's something for them to think about in their own careers.
Which brings me to a question about academics as activists. I mean, today we see a lot of public policy based on the studies of academics around this country. But who are these academics? How are they being shaped? What is the climate today for academics? And what is at risk if you want to take a radical stand and study, for example, the black underclass?
Well, I think that there's some worthwhile things that can happen, but I think that the environment pushes toward conformance rather than toward controversy, rather than toward confrontation, you see. That's how they got tenure. That's how they moved up. And there too few of them have been actually involved in struggle. What do the communists say? That they have theory without praxis. What does the book of James say? Faith without works is dead, standing alone. It's a marvelous thing. You got to combine them both. And they're, I think some of these studies maybe that we were talking about on the employment, on the gaps in the wealth, if those were put together by people who were not only experts in their field but had been out in the field, you see, they might be more convincing. They people might have a different slant on them.
Can you get tenure if you do that kind of work?
It's very tough. I think not impossible. I think many more of those who are denied tenure because of their political views need to fight it. A white woman at Harvard who was denied tenure clearly on the basis of political beliefs did go to court, and the law school or the university settled for amounts around $300,000. Now, I don't believe Harvard is that rich that if they felt that they were in the right that they would have settled that case. The problem is that most people are so concerned that creating a litigation in one place might hurt your chances in getting a job someplace else that they just go quietly.
Well, Dr. Bell, what do you think of Henry Louis Gates' attempt to build Harvard into a powerhouse of black political thinking and theory?
It certainly is an impressive effort. I mean, certainly has attracted some very big names. And you hope for the best. The problem is that it is...
You don't sound too optimistic.
It is being created within that environment. Right now, it's of great benefit to Harvard. Suppose these big names got together and came up with a program that the Harvard people didn't like. Suppose they all decided, well, we're fine in this little atmosphere, but look at the rest of the university. We still have only a few people of color. We're going to go on strike and take leave without pay until 10% of the faculty are persons of color. It'd be interesting to see. You see how it would give their academic work a kind of legitimacy out in the community, and replace the suspicion that you probably heard even in my voice or the sense of caution. And that I think it would be a wonderful thing. I wouldn't want to hold my breath until they do it.
Derek Bell, could you read a little from your book, Gospel Choir, Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home, and talk about the role of gospel music in politics and in African-American life?
Well, in this book, I finally prevailed on the publishers not to use blurbs. That's when you write to all your friends and say, would you say something good about the book that we put on the back? I said, that's crazy. But they said, no, you got to do it. And long and short, but this is what I wrote instead. For gospel singers, the biblical suggestion to make a joyful noise unto the Lord is less an admonition than an invitation to renew through song the faith of our forebears. Gladly and without pretense or frivolity, they praise the Lord through the intricacies of lyric, melody, rhythm, and harmony. Rooted deep in black culture, blessed with talent, honed in belief, these singers and their music comfort the afflicted, console the bereaved, strengthen the weak, reassure the discouraged, and bring all within the sound of their voices a soulful joy. I guess one of the efforts in the book is to, as my character Geneva Crenshaw puts it, either in the music itself or in the determination to keep going sparked and nurtured by the music, our enslaved ancestors did what we must learn to do. We are experiencing again the racial hostility resulting from the anxiety of millions. Millions of whites whose jobs have disappeared or are endangered by technology and corporate greed. In this crisis, even our best efforts may prove inadequate. Surrender, though, is not an option. Through unified struggle, we must garner our strength as a people and face whatever the future holds while singing the songs of Zion. Now, the next thing you're supposed to ask me is, how does that translate into action for November, right?
You asked right. It. Now answer it.
Very tough. I think that the message of my book, not directly but indirectly, is that we cannot surrender. You don't stay home. Even though the choice between the Democrats and Republicans is a choice between one corporate-sponsored party and another corporate-sponsored party. But I think that what we, black and white, who are concerned about this thing need to do is recognize that casting the vote alone is probably worse than simply staying at home. That in addition to casting the vote, you have to be active. You have to be on the case of those folk in power. It's what an old woman told me down in Mississippi years ago, where I'd foolishly gone and tried to desegregate their schools and subjected those people to all manner of harassment and terror and everything else. And I asked the woman, how does she keep going? How does she stay in the struggle? And she said, Derek, I'm an old woman. I can't talk for the other people in the community. But as for me, I lives to harass white folks. In other words, it wasn't a racial thing because she had some white neighbors who were quite supportive. But the people who had the power, the people who had the money, the people who had the guns were white. And poor old as she was, her commitment was to stay on them. And I think her commitment is one that we have to understand and adopt. Not only is it the way to try to get these leaders, whether they're Republican or Democratic, to do at least in part what they're supposed to do as opposed to what they're paid to do by those who are able through corporate contributions to make those payments. But it's also a way to gain a kind of salvation ourselves. You see, Mrs. The woman down in Mississippi, once she had made that commitment, she, in a sense, had already triumphed. They might come and run her down the next day, but she had already overcome that which they were trying to do through fear, through intimidation. She was going to stay on them, and whatever the outcome, she had already gained a kind of victory. And we need to do that. It's hard. Maybe it was easier down that little rural a place where the dangers were so real. Here we have all kinds of temptations and distractions and rationalizations. Well, he's not as bad as the other guy, kind of thing. But we know in many ways he is. And he's not going to get better unless we insist that he gets better.
Dr. Bell, there are those who would say that your prescription of gospel as a spirit to help us, you know, maintain ourselves through this dark period is in fact a surrender of sorts. I mean, faced with the permanence of racism, as you correctly point out, shouldn't we be doing something much more assertive and perhaps even more nationalistic than thinking of a gospel as a metaphor?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I think it is a surrender of notions of ambition and success as this world measures them. It's a surrender of the thought that if I can't win, I shouldn't run. It's a embracing of that which our slave forebears had to embrace, a recognition that though this life would always be lived in chains, that there was more to this life than that which the overseers, the owners, could control. We see that in the music, which is reflective of the religion, which is more a theology in song. It's more than just lyrics. If you hear, you know, I gave my soul to the Lord, and I never will turn back. Oh, I will go, I shall go, to see what the end will be. And then in this century, James Cleveland saying, I don't feel no ways tired.
Don't feel no ways tired, Lord.
I've come too far from where I started from.
I've come too far. From where I started from.
Nobody told me the road would be easy.
Nobody told me that the road would be easy.
I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
Bring me this far and just leave me. I'm gonna say it one more time. I don't feel no waste time. Sing it for me, Keith.
Come to pardon, Lord,
where I started from.
It's an embracing of that which brings a kind of triumph through commitment that no number of defeats can destroy.
It's been a pleasure, Derek Bell, author of Gospel Choir's Psalms of Survival in an Alien Land Called Home. And of course, thank you, Salim.
I'm going to join the heavenly choir. I'm going to sing and never get tired. I'm going to sing hallelujah.
Yes, Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Thanks to Lou Henkins and Bill Wax for today's musical selections, which include James Cleveland, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Mahalia Jackson. If you'd like to buy a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.